This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I'm surprised by the level of the anger of the people. Where were you yesterday? Yesterday, did you see that the hospitals were not kept, the roads were not kept, the sewage were not kept, the dam was like, what are you dreaming?
That's Karim Mazran, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafik Harir Center. Details coming up. Also, the EU has awarded a $5 million grant to an African-led consortium, and the U.S. military has resumed counter-terrorism missions in Niger. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Walls of water swept thousands of Libyans to their deaths after Storm Daniel smashed ashore days ago. Now bodies are washing back onto land in eastern Libya and crews are struggling to bury them. Libyan officials said today the death toll has risen to at least 8,000, with 10,000 people missing. Karim Mazram, senior fellow at the Rafik Harir Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. Mazram, who is from Tripoli, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that broken roads, other neglected infrastructure, and the country's civil conflict have all contributed to a massive humanitarian disaster.
Derna is a city that was surrounded a few years ago by the army and kept isolated and under siege because it was supposed to be, according to Haftar and his troops, a seat of Islamist terrorists and extremists. So the roads have been closed, things have been shut down, the city had been neglected for years. It was neglected under Gaddafi, and became, it was even more so after Haftar. So that particular area, the city of Derna, is difficult to reach, very poorly maintained, barely organized. And if you take the standard, not average standard of Libya in general, which are very low, central hospitals in Tripoli, they ask you to bring the toilet paper with you when you go to the hospital. So you can imagine a city that has been under siege, marginalized, and feared by the dictator of the East, General Haftar, in what condition the city was before. So when such a tragedy happens, it almost goes sans dire. Given these conditions, an event, half the strength of the one they really attacked would have already been terrible. Dams, I'm sure there has been no maintenance whatsoever for years. Roads have not been maintained. Really, Carola, whatever you touch, whatever you say, you find the cause. All of the dead are also because there is no organized civil protection. So when this happens, people find out then that there is no government, found out then that sometimes I'm surprised by the level of the anger of the people. Where were you yesterday? Yesterday, did you see that the hospitals were not kept, that the roads were not kept, that the sewage were not kept, that the dam was like, what are you dreaming?
Do you think that maybe that there is anger there, there is outrage, but they just are afraid to speak up? Or they have been before the floods?
Yeah, of course it is. Of course. So I cannot blame the people. I mean, I myself, I'm living abroad. I'm not living there yelling against Haftar. Because fate, as always, it's nice to talk from a comfortable chair in Washington, D.C. about something happening with people that are under the fear of being killed or being repressed. So I know that very well. But at the same time, I cannot but say, guys, you can be angry today, but this anger should have been coalesced somehow and somehow exposed civilly before, because maybe not a flood was not expected, but an earthquake in Libya is like the whole central Mediterranean crust is very seismic. So you can expect that. God forbid a big earthquake like the one hit Morocco, it's Libya. We are in the same identical situation. Okay, everything is tragic. Everything is a disaster. Everything. So, but now is not the moment to criticize without any end. This is the moment to be constructive. This is the moment to be telling the European, the Americans, the international community, whatever they mean, the neighbor states, Algeria and Egypt especially, and Tunisia to a certain extent. The Turks who are present in Libya with a strong force and they trained the Libyan army. So all these people that have it, they get together.
Sorry. Is that happening, though? You know, when there is no sense of a strong federal government, what kind of international help is being coordinated?
It's an ad hoc. Every organization, every state talks to their friend in Tripoli, their friend in Benghazi. They try to get to Derna. They couldn't get to Derna. The streets are broken. So who's going to clean the streets to allow the other? There is no organization. It's random. In the hands of the goodwill of a number of organizations, the well-trained American, Italian, civil protection come. They are taking care of a piece, taking care of another piece. There is no that I'm aware of yet, because it takes control of the ground.
That's Karim Mazram, senior fellow at the Rafik Harir Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. As you just heard, Storm Danielle hit Libya's northeast coast with devastating effect. As the death toll began to mount, both the eastern-based Government of National Stability and the Government of National Unity in Tripoli promised support for devastated communities and rescue operations. Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi whether the enormity of the tragedy could play a role in ending Libya's political stalemate and highlighting that most Libyans want a united country.
I think it has the potential to do that. I think it, certainly on the level of ordinary Libyan people, we've seen a real outpouring of solidarity and efforts to raise money, to send aid, to get rescuers in to the devastated areas in eastern Libya. And I think that has come across really strongly. We have seen moves by the GNU and the GNS and kind of rival authorities in across Libya, all also trying to help and to send aid. And we have seen that there are issues with the coordination because of the division, because of the lack of previous coordination, that actually is making it much more difficult for rescuers to get to the areas that are needed. I think it's also making it more difficult for international organisations coming in because there's uncertainty about which authorities to deal with, who to liaise with, and that is making things more difficult. However, this kind of tragedy is showing that the authorities are able to attempt to work together and are trying to work together. The fear is, I think, that once these first few days of kind of the emergency response are over, that then there will be more of a blame game and that the status quo actors will attempt to use this more for their own kind of political games and messaging. So it may be a short-lived kind of act of unity, but the hope is that the kind of unity and solidarity shown by the Libyan people will almost force the politicians to continue on this kind of track of attempting to have greater unity within the country.
Is there a possibility of the tragedy resulting in aid rivalry as both sides seek to outperform the other in providing assistance and to demonstrate publicly their concern about the plight of those affected?
Yes, I think that's definitely the case. I think, you know, we're already seeing that in terms of the different governments and different agencies, you know, wanting to show the other that they are committing as much financial and kind of other resources. I think that's probably likely to continue, and I think we'll get more fraught as the days go on. We're already seeing that it's difficult for these different aid agencies and convoys to get into certain places, into Derna, for example. You know, a lot of the infrastructure has been destroyed, so I think we're going to see a narrative around that over, you know, who has been able to help and who hasn't. And I think very quickly it will start, you know, deteriorating into kind of a politicisation of that. I think there's also been quite a lot of anger among Libyans around the kind of international response to this as well. Although we're starting to see more media coverage of it now, it has been quite slow and limited coming in, and also the support from international actors. So I think the kind of attempts by different international actors to provide support may also be playing into this element of politicisation of the aid.
Anger over the state of Libya's preparedness for such a disaster and over its civil defenses is likely to soar in coming days with all the present political elite coming under attack. Could the disaster end up triggering a political storm for both the GNU and the GNS, especially if the death toll continues to grow and aid operations are slow to provide support?
Yes, I definitely think so. Already there's, you know, very important questions being asked about, you know, why the toll of this flooding has been so bad. The, you know, one of the key things that happened in Derna was the two of the dams burst, and it seems that there were reports indicating that actually it had been flagged previously that, you know, there was a danger if there was some significant amounts of rainfall that this could burst and, you know, could have devastating effects, which is what has happened. So I think there will be a lot of questions around how the eastern authorities managed, you know, the infrastructure and elements in there. Also Derna itself, which is one of the worst affected cities, has a long history of being marginalized. It was a key kind of center of Islamists a few years ago, and since then has been kind of ostracized and marginalized by the Eastern authorities. So I think that will play into a lot of the anger. On the other side, you know, a long-standing Eastern grievance is that the Eastern region has not received as much in the way of resources and funding and attention from Tripoli. So I think that will also play into it. And I think overarching all of this, whether East or West, the kind of long-standing grievance among normal Libyans about the corruption and the kind of abuse of political position that we see throughout the Libyan kind of elite. So I think certainly that those questions are going to become more and more prominent. I think the anger is going to grow. The question will be how these political elites respond to it and what happens next. I think in the short term, it's going to be focused on the disaster management. But in the days and weeks after, I think this could be a real watershed moment for Libya in terms of what happens next.
That was Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shinawi. In Morocco, many quake survivors spent a sixth night under the stars and will likely do so again tonight. Friday's 6.8 magnitude earthquake killed nearly 3,000 people and injured more than 5,500 others. With many roads in the high Atlas Mountains still blocked by landslides, some villagers are using donkeys loaded with supplies to reach remote areas with no vehicle access. Field hospitals and shelters have been set up in more accessible areas. Some of the higher elevations have yet to receive help. Some villages were almost entirely flattened. Reuters reports on the ground said Wednesday there is a marked increase in the number of troops, police, and relief workers near the epicenter, and helicopters continue to fly overhead. They said medics are treating broken bones and trauma injuries from falling buildings. In an Africa-led consortium has been awarded a $5 million grant from the European Union to help prevent new pandemics. Reporter Vicky Stark has more from Cape Town.
Professor Tulio de Oliveira is the head of the Network of Genomic Surveillance in South Africa, whose members are credited with identifying the Beta and Omicron variants of COVID. De Oliveira also is the director of Stellenbosch University's Center for Epidemic Response and Innovation, or CERI. The center and its partners, the National Institute of Health of Mozambique, the International Livestock Research Institute in Kenya, the Global Health Institute at the University of Antwerp, Belgium, and Link Management, a German company, have won a $5 million grant from the European Union. The grant funds genome research to help track and possibly prevent diseases capable of causing pandemics, such as COVID.
So the best way to prepare for a pandemic, is to be responding to the current epidemics. So you have a trained workforce, systems to respond for a new epidemic or pandemic that comes. And that's what we do in this grant.
De Oliveira says they've decided to look at major diseases affecting South Africa, Mozambique, and Kenya, including dengue, tuberculosis, and HIV.
And then Mozambique and South Africa, also with cholera, we have this awful epidemics recently. And with Kenya, we're going to be focused on emergent viruses such as Rift Valley fever.
He says Rift Valley fever, which is being amplified by climate change, has pandemic potential, and their program produces genomes that will be used by another large consortium in South Africa, the mRNA hub of the World Health Organization, to design a vaccine. Another area of study is COVID, which killed at least 250,000 people on the African continent. He says the Network of Genomic Surveillance of South Africa meets every week to share information on the latest COVID variants. They are currently looking at 16 related genomes.
And what we saw is that potentially we have a wave of infection, of this new lineage, but that do not translate in any sign of increase of hospitalization or deaths, which is very good news.
Having said that, De Oliveira added that South Africa's Department of Health has advised that older people or those with significant health issues should get a booster vaccine. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The top U.S. Air Force commander for Europe and Africa says the U.S. military has resumed counter-terrorism missions in Niger, including flying drones and other aircraft out of Niger bases that were halted by a coup. U.S. forces have been largely confined to their bases, but General James Hacker says a large number of the missions have resumed in recent weeks, although not 100%. In a statement, Pentagon Press Secretary Brigadier General Pat Ryder confirmed that the U.S. was flying missions again, but said they were confined to protecting U.S. forces. The U.S. has made Niger its main regional outpost for a wide-ranging patrols by armed drones and other counter-terror operations against Islamic extremist movements. In Goma, in the eastern part of the DRC, relatives of dozens of people killed by the Republican Guard on August 30th in protests against peacekeepers are angry about the conditions in which the bodies are being kept. The corpses are piled up in the military hospital at Camp Katindo, and local residents are complaining about the odor coming from the hospital. The families say they have not been allowed to bury their dead yet. Reporter Zanem Nati Zaidi reports from Goma.
The Congolese army and family members of the victims of the bloodshed of August 30th, which left more than 50 dead, began examining the bodies on Tuesday at the morgue of the military hospital at Camp Katindo. But the deterioration of the bodies has prevented many from recognizing their loved ones. Francis Mwengehere is looking for his paternal uncle. He says he is at the mortuary today because they have been asked, the families, to identify and collect the bodies of their beloved who died on August 30th. He lost his paternal uncle, and after checking at the mortuary, he cannot find his body because all of them are decomposing. Today, it is difficult to spend more than an hour near the military hospital. The environment is rife with the smell of bodies. Julien Kulimushi, a resident of this part of town, has already moved her children to protect them from disease. She hides her face with a mask to attenuate the odors. She says many bodies of their fellow countrymen killed in Nyabushongo and Ndosho have been brought to a mortuary that cannot hold them all. They produce unbearable stench, so residents can no longer eat food at home. They have already moved their children farther out of the city. The president of Savel Society in Goma, Marion Ngavo, is asking authorities to resolve what has become a public health problem. He says the conservation measures do not respect regulations on the management of corpses. Savile Society is therefore giving the authorities 48 hours to organize their burial and try to sanitize the area where the corpses are kept. A dead city day or strike was partly observed in Goma on Wednesday to demand a dignified burial for those killed by Congolese soldiers 2 weeks ago. There has so far been no response from authorities. For VOA Africa, I'm Zanem Netizaidi in Goma.
Nigeria experienced a nationwide power outage today after a fire at a power plant collapsed the electrical grid. The grid had shut down several times in recent years in a country that is a major oil exporter and one of Africa's wealthiest nations. Many people in the country are frustrated with the situation. Gracie Adams is a public servant, and she shared her frustration with a reporter in Abuja.
I'm actually not happy about it. I don't know what to say. I'm speechless. This is collapsing everything. If the national grid collapses, everything collapses, you know. So, I mean, people are struggling to survive. They use electricity for businesses and all of that. And this is just not good. It's not good at all.
Ben Dudu says the grid problems add to the economic and other struggles of Nigerians.
It is really sad to hear this news again that the grid has collapsed. Like, how many times is the grid going to collapse in 1 year? This should be like the third or the fourth time. It is really painful. See, Nigerians are going through a lot. First, it was fuel subsidy, and that has not been resolved. We have not seen the palliatives and all that, and now we are hearing the national grid. Can the government just do something for Nigerians to breathe? We are going through a lot. President Tinubu, we are calling on you, please. Let Nigerians breathe. We know this is beyond you, but do something about it.
Public servant Jane Eki says someone should be held accountable for the repeated outages.
At times like this, I actually wonder what privatization means. Who should be held responsible for the national grid collapsing? Something needs to be done. We can't continue having blackouts as a result of national grid collapsing when Nigeria supplies electricity to other countries. No, it's not right.
Steve Isabu is a journalist, and he wants to know why there never has been a full explanation for the repeated grid outages.
Every time national grid has collapsed, what is going on? Why is our national grid always collapsing? Why are people who are supposed to do something about it, what are they doing about it? It can't be happening once, twice, three times. Somebody should give us an answer. Why this grid collapse is not being addressed once and for all.
The power went out nationwide shortly after midnight. By early afternoon, national and international media reported it was gradually coming back on. Because of frequent local and national outages, many Nigerian homes and businesses have backup generators. However, after the government eliminated subsidies for fuel a few months ago, the cost of running them has risen sharply. Tunisia has barred entry to a delegation from the European Parliament after some EU lawmakers criticized the deal Brussels struck with Tunis to stem migration. Legislators from the Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee were due to head to the North African country today on a fact-finding mission. But in a letter seen by the French news agency AFP, Tunisia's foreign ministry said the lawmakers would not be allowed entry due to multiple reservations about the visit. A member of the European delegation, Mounir Satouri, told the Associated, French news agency, never in at least 20 years has a regime allowed itself to refuse an official delegation from the Foreign Affairs Committee, and to say that even if we made the trip, we would be turned back at the border. The incident comes after the European Union inked a memorandum of understanding in July with Tunisia aimed at curbing irregular migration across the Mediterranean. Under the deal, Brussels had promised potentially hundreds of millions of euros in financial support for the government in Tunis. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest development on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Shogun Chung, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station.